Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After a riotous pro-Trump mob breached the U.S. Capitol building last week, a handful of them headed to the office of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. During a tour of the ransacked office with 60 Minutes correspondent Leslie Stahl, Pelosi explained why President Trump has to go.
The person who's running the executive branch is a deranged, unhinged, dangerous president of the United States. And only a number of days until we can be protected from him. But he has done something so serious that there should be prosecution against him.
The House this morning moves forward on two fronts to remove Trump from office 5 days after the pro-Trump rioters breached the U.S. Capitol building. Joining us is Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump, who covers politics. He's following the developments. Welcome back, Philip.
Thank you very much.
House Democrats will move on a resolution calling on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to relieve the president of his duties. Where does support for this line up with Democrats and Republicans?
Well, the upshot is that the Democrats are trying to give every opportunity to say they did what they could short of impeachment in order to get Donald Trump removed from office. I mean, I think that broadly speaking, for a variety of reasons, it's not likely that President Trump will be removed before January 20th, including the fact that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who will still be Majority Leader probably through the 20th, has indicated there won't be any vote on articles of impeachment. People may remember it was only a year ago that we had this vote of impeachment in the House, and then we actually have the trial in the Senate. That's not going to happen before January 20th anyway. But essentially what's happening is they're saying that they want to encourage this revocation of Trump's power under the 25th Amendment in order to say, look, we tried to do everything we could short of impeachment, but the odds are extremely low that that will happen. And then they'll just move forward with a second impeachment.
The vice president has to respond within 24 hours to this resolution, I guess. What do we know about where he stands on the issue? Has he talked to anybody?
No, there are indications that he has not ruled it out, according to reporting. One can take that as one wishes. I mean, I think it's very unlikely for Mike Pence, who has both been loyal to Trump and obviously is still wants to have some sort of future in the Republican Party. I think it's unlikely that he'll take that really, really remarkable and unprecedented step, and a step that would require more than half of the cabinet to actually go along with it in order for it to be affected. But one person who hasn't talked to Pence is Trump. Reporting suggests that the two have not spoken since Wednesday morning, in other words, before the storming of the Capitol, which is just remarkable for a variety of reasons, including the fact that, Mike Pence's life was one of those that was on the line when the rioters made their way into the Capitol. There were people actually seeking him out, and that the president and he haven't spoken subsequently is just frankly astonishing.
I'd love to talk about his future in the GOP anyway, regardless of how he goes forward with this. But first, I want to ask you, House Democrats plan to introduce articles of impeachment. That's today, or they're going to vote out today and then vote on them tomorrow, something like that. And we keep hearing, well, there's just not enough time, but they're not constricted by the timeline of a presidency, are they?
No, they're not. Yeah. I mean, you can impeach someone after they've left the White House. There's actually some talk prior to Hillary Clinton being potentially elected in 2016 that she might be impeached before she even became president.
Okay.
There is no such boundary. And there has been some talk. Representative James Clyburn from South Carolina, in fact, has said that maybe they'll wait until after the first 100 days of the Biden administration have been completed. The reason why, obviously, is that you might want to do that if you are Democratic leadership is it removes things to the back burner a little bit. But there are still actual ramifications. If you impeach President Trump successfully, and that vote is then upheld in the Senate by a two-thirds majority, you can, for example, prevent President Trump from ever holding elected federal office again, which may be something that is desirable. There are other, essentially, you can put into the articles of impeachment a broad range of things. You could strip him of his national security clearance, things along those lines. There are lots of things that you can do with impeachment that are beyond simply removing someone from office.
And the idea of waiting until after the first 100 days is just to give the Biden administration a stage of its own?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there is some interest, particularly if it is not the case that you're going to be able to remove President Trump from office, to simply say, yes, there need to be repercussions for this, but we don't necessarily want the first days of President Biden's administration to be hanging under this cloud of what is viewed, however sincerely, by a lot of people on the right as being recriminatory targeting of the president.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what's ahead in our nation's capital after the rioters breached the U.S. Capitol building. I'm talking right now with Philip Bump. He's Washington Post national political correspondent. The president has not commented publicly over the weekend or expressed sympathy even, and correct me, of course, if I'm wrong, for the Capitol police officer who was killed in the rioting or by rioters. Is the president scheduled to make any remarks, hold a press conference, anything?
Yeah, I mean, I was just, when you said that, it's sort of remarkable because Donald Trump's primary way of expressing his sentiment, obviously, is through his Twitter account and Facebook accounts. He doesn't have access to those anymore. So, yeah, I mean, it has been a period of unusual silence from President Trump. But I think it's safe to say that it's solely a function of the fact that he doesn't have Twitter and Facebook. It is a little surprising that he hasn't, for example, gone on Fox News and had one of his sycophantic hosts of Fox News, you know, letting him say whatever he wants to say for half an hour. There is potentially going to be a statement that he releases today, which specifically addresses the crisis of the moment, which is that he had his Twitter account taken away. You know, he's supposed to potentially today talk about the role of big tech and yada, 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 which is something he's been hammering on about for a while, but obviously is felt more acutely by him in this moment. He's also tomorrow going to be traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border to the town of Alamo in order to talk about the border wall. I suspect strongly that he will not take questions from reporters. I would be very surprised if he does again before he leaves office. And, you know, I mean, I think he recognizes it doesn't do him a lot of good to be interrogated on the subject. But I think that he also has a lot he wants to say. And so we'll figure out where the line is drawn between those two things.
Republican National Committee members met over the weekend to talk about the future of the party. Short term, long term, what do you think their calculations are, Philip Bump?
I mean, it's an unenviable situation. The party has very heavily invested itself in being the party of President Trump to the extent that its 2020 campaign platform was essentially Trumpism, in a word, and yeah, not much more than that. You know, I mean, that has led to and exacerbated this moment where there's been a massive investment in President Trump as an individual candidate. He has gobbled up a lot of the resources and institutional power of the Republican Party in order to support himself, which leaves the party really weakened. Yeah, I mean, they're still winning campaigns and they still have a lot of elected officials, but there's going to be a massive leadership vacuum. The extent to which President Trump can hold that position, I mean, we saw, for example, after President Obama left office in 2016, he still had a voice, but he, A, was willing to do the sort of traditional thing of not weighing in on his successor, and, you know, B, was not the same sort of politician that is Donald Trump. Trump, without his Twitter account, you know, what does that mean in terms of his leadership role within the party? But the party doesn't really have a clear path forward. And it's really bifurcated between those who support the often fascistic tendencies of President Trump and those who support more traditional Republican policies. And, you know, it's not clear who's going to win, although I will say that the development over the past few days of, for example, large businesses saying they're going to withhold contributions from those who supported the effort to block the finalization of the Electoral College vote, that could be big. You know, that could have significant ramifications. That and, you know, potentially shutting down social media accounts of bad actors who are aligned with the Republican Party. It's very, very hard to say in this moment where this all lands.
And I read someone who spoke anonymously from the RNC about the meetings that they're having right now said, we can't afford to lose that 74 million voters who supported Trump in the 2020 election. Is it really the RNC or the Republicans to lose, or is it Trump's to hang on to?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the core questions. And it sounds like my son's having a bit of a tantrum.
Understood,
in the background.
Been there.
forgive me for that. Yeah, I mean, it's there was a great poll that was done by YouGov for the Huffington Post that came out on Friday, and it asked people, where do your loyalties lie? Do they lie more with the Republican Party? Do they lie more with President Trump? Most Republicans, I shouldn't say most, a plurality of Republicans said that their sympathies lie more with Trump than with the party. Obviously, that was more the case among Trump voters, 40% or so of whom said their loyalties lay more with Trump. So Trump really does command a lot of loyalty. Now, granted, we are in a post-election period, which has been very contentious, in which Donald Trump has actively fostered that sense of loyalty to himself. You know, asking for example, election results to be tossed, even though Republicans won, because he lost, right? So it's unclear how sustained that will be, particularly if President Trump's ability to reach out to that base of people is constrained by the fact that he doesn't have access to the same social media platform that he does. But that is the core question for the Republican Party right now, is can they figure out a way to navigate a middle ground between being the party of Trump and maintaining Donald Trump's base of support? I think we have seen two examples to suggest that they're not going to be able to do that. And that is the 2018 midterm elections and the Georgia special elections. In neither case was Donald Trump on the ballot, and the party got absolutely blown away, right? You know, I mean, granted, Georgia, they got blown away. They lost by 1 point and 2 points, but those are big losses.
In Georgia, right? In
Georgia, in a state that hasn't been blue in a long, long time.
Right.
2018, I think, is a bigger warning sign. In 2020, they managed to hold on, but Trump was on the ballot. Trump's not going to be on the ballot in 2022 and 2024. And I think they would very rightly be concerned about what that means for them electorally.
Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio tweeted over the weekend that his fellow senators, Josh Hawley of Missouri and Ted Cruz of Texas, both Republicans, should resign for their roles in perpetuating the falsehoods about the election outcome. What's the sense about what their futures hold, given their connection to what happened last week?
I mean, these are both senators who represent traditionally red states. Texas actually is probably less red now than Missouri in a lot of ways. But the extent to which elected officials are held accountable by the voters depends upon the fact that, you know, that the United States is an incredibly polarized country. And Cruz won re-election 4 years ago, I guess 3 years ago, in a relatively close contest over Beto O'Rourke. But, you know, that this was it was closer than it needed to be, I think, for him as a Republican running in Texas, except for the fact that it was a 2018 election. And, and that was, you know, Trump wasn't on the ballot, as we were just discussing. So in terms of electoral repercussions, I'm not sure how necessarily concerned they need to be. And I also don't think that there's any real sense that other Republicans are going to hold them to account. Both of them, when they engaged in this charade of supporting President Trump's effort to block the electoral vote count, they used rationalizations which weren't necessarily predicated on fraud. Cruz's rationalization was, well, people are really concerned about this, so let's have this commission that actually studies the thing. Josh Hawley's was, actually, I'm just worried about the constitutionality of a 2019 Pennsylvania law and whether or not people should be able to cast absentee ballots, right? They came up with these excuses that were not predicated on Trump's falsehoods so that they could have plausible deniability in the future. This is exactly the moment for which they did that. They did that plausible deniability, to have deniability, when people came to them and said, hey, look, you supported this insurrection effort. And they could say, well, no, I was just concerned about Pennsylvania's constitutionality, right? I mean, they gave themselves this sort of cover. They're both from red states. I think that they're, you know, they may be a bit chastened, but I'm not sure they necessarily need to worry.
But just real quick, a footnote, Texas is expected to fall next. As far as being a red state, it came very close this time. I mean, when you talk about Georgia, the next thing that's usually uttered is, well, Texas is next.
Yeah, I mean, look, Texas is definitely trending in that direction. But I think we saw a couple of things this time, which suggest that maybe it's not as imminent. I mean, I remember writing in 2014 about how Georgia was on the brink of turning blue. But with Texas, we saw a couple of things. The first is that it really wasn't that close. You know, there's a lot of polling suggesting it would be fairly close. Texas, unless I'm mistaken, this is off the top of my head, but I think it was less close between Trump and Biden than it was between Cruz and O'Rourke. Okay. But then secondarily, we also saw a lot of shift among the Hispanic vote in Texas, which I think was unexpected, maybe specifically related to Trump. It's sort of hard to say until we see more election results. But we did not see this sort of both in Florida and Texas, and to a lesser extent in Arizona, the same sort of vote from Hispanic voters in those states for the Democrat that we might have expected, which may make things more complicated in that end further down the line.
And just before I let you go, Philip, extremists are posting dangerous messages on social media, calling for more violence, more killing, especially in connection with the upcoming inauguration of President-elect Biden. You know, we could spend a whole hour just talking about the Capitol Police response to the events on Wednesday. But be that as it may, what is there a sense that they're getting their act together now?
Well, there are a couple of challenges. One is that the leadership all left. after the attack of last Wednesday. So that obviously necessarily adds a new challenge. You know, I mean, I think the fundamental issue from Wednesday that is going to be the immediate place that the people start is the scale of the number of people that was there made it very hard to have any sort of effective defense. And so I think there's going to be a lot of attention paid to the scale of what might be expected in the Capitol and in other places over the coming weeks. But this is an unenviable situation in every single sense of the word unenviable. I think I don't have the expertise to say much more than I, like everyone else, are keeping my fingers crossed.
Philip Bump, Washington Post national political correspondent, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Of course, and go Bucks.
He's also, by the way, a graduate of Ohio State University. We will be right back with our weekly reporter roundtable, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
President Trump's continued refusal to accept the election results without producing credible evidence of a rigged election has started a fire that has threatened to burn down our democracy.
And with that, Governor Mike DeWine offered his sharpest rebuke of the president to date following the deadly riots in the U.S. Capitol last week as lawmakers met to certify electoral votes. The governor said all Americans must accept the results of the election in order to begin to heal. That may be easier said than done. 147 Republicans objected to the certification, including five members from Ohio. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Farnoosh Amiri. She's a State House reporter for the Associated Press, and it's her first time on the show. Welcome to the show, Farnoosh.
Thanks so much.
And also Dayton Daily News state government reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back, Laura.
Hey, good morning, Ann.
And USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back and congratulations on your promotion, Jackie.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well done. Laura, Governor DeWine has been careful about criticizing Trump, like every other Republican in the country, basically, during his 4 years in office. What struck you about his statements made on Thursday last week?
Well, I thought it was his sharpest rebuke of President Trump to date. I thought it was, you know, he said that that the president lit the match and incited the mob. But at the same time, he didn't kind of retract his support of the president. He didn't say, you know, I regret supporting him. He said that the reasons for supporting him in the first place remained valid, which was to get conservatives on the federal bench and strike new trade policies. So, you know, he definitely blasted Trump, but then he didn't take the next step.
What do you think, Farnoosh? I mean, what kind of impression did you get from the Republican governor's remarks?
I agree with Laura. I think it was stunning to see that this was what pushed DeWine to make these kind of statements. I mean, it is an extreme event to push any person on either side to rebuke the president, but he seemed extremely fed up. And I think a lot of this also has to do with President Trump has 9 days left in office. I think the timing of calling out the president by Republican governors or officials is it's an easier time to call out someone when there is this collective reckoning against him by the GOP. But nonetheless, it was stunning. And I think it really was just a new moment for DeWine, especially as he's considering re-election.
You know, Jackie Borchardt, the Republican National Committee met over the weekend down in Florida. The Ohio Republican Party has its own struggles because of the House Bill 6 scandal that is still unresolved at this point. You know, there's a long way to go on that score. I'm wondering about the Ohio Republican Party. Any sense of reverberations for the party here in Ohio now that, like, so is, you know, Ohio is demonstrably a red state now, but still, what about the party?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one that we plan to kind of watch. Ohio Republican Party Chairman Jane Timken did put out an initial statement on Wednesday. They've been pretty quiet since then. And your listeners are probably aware that the party had booted their previous chairman, Matt Borges, who was a Kasich guy, in order to put, and he did not support Donald Trump in Trump's 2016 election. And after Trump won, you know, they replaced him with Jane Timken, who pre-Trump even has been a good fundraiser for the party, and a strong member within the party, but also, as we've seen, is very supportive of Trump and throughout the last 4+ years. You know, Ohio has held a special place in the president's heart. I think, you know, he always talks about how much he loves Ohio and has a great chairman and, you know, great people that helped him get elected. So I think, you know, with Trump gone, with all of this that happened last week and the fallout from that, today I can't say what's going to happen, but I can't imagine it won't affect the state party and how they run.
Yeah, Laura Bischoff.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is yesterday, the Ohio Republican Party's homepage still had a photo of Donald Trump in a large crowd, and the headline on it was something like, "Your president needs you." It was almost like it was still backing and cheering for President Trump and maybe even fundraising. They changed it as of this morning. And last night around 7:30, Jane Timken did put out a statement, saying she's heartbroken over the riots and the deaths, and that they have to, you know, remember that the Republican Party is bigger than one person, et cetera. So the shift has started to happen, but I'm surprised it didn't happen already, that they would kind of try to turn a page.
You know, I just think it's important to note that webpage that had been up since 2019.
So it already was stale.
It wasn't something that, yeah, it wasn't, just to be clear, it wasn't something that was put up in the last few days or weeks,
yeah, yeah,
or months. It's just, maybe it's a situation where someone forgot to take it down, but yeah, you'd think they would have thought to take it down before last week or before today or yesterday, whenever it did take.
You know, I wonder, given the way the party spend money, in other words, you can give money to the party, but you can't necessarily, well, I'm sure some people do direct where the money goes, but all things being equal, is there a sense that, I mean, fundraising is a big part of, you know, Republican success. We've heard about Marriott and others starting to pull back funding from the national party. I suppose it could trickle down to the state parties. Is that an immediate concern, Laura?
Well, I mean, you know, money and cash is the mother's milk of politics, right? So, right, of course, they're going to be really concerned about fundraising. It seems like the Republicans have long held the fundraising advantage over the Democrats. You know, a lot of the money, a lot of the fundraising and money in politics, though, has really shifted into the 501c4s, these so-called dark money groups. Mm-hmm. It's just astounding to see the amount of cash that businesses infused into, for example, the Generation Now, the 501c4 that was used to funnel money into the householders' effort to get House Bill 6, according to the federal prosecutors, and some of the other 501c4s that Dayton Daily News has been looking at. And I know that Jesse Balmert from the Inquirer has been doing some good work on that front as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's money that has found its way into dark money groups that support the governor and also his daughter, Alice DeWine, who was running and unsuccessfully ran for Greene County prosecutor.
Right. A lot of that money came from Partners for Progress, which is funded by First Energy. And it looks like, there was, I think, 107, Jackie might have the numbers off the top of her head, but I think it was $175,000 that went into Alice DeWine's, it wasn't really hers, but it advocated on her behalf,
right,
in the Republican primary for Greene County prosecutor just last April. And a good chunk of that came from Securing Ohio's Future, which is the 501c4 group that supported the DeWine-Husted ticket for governor. And that group got money from Partners for Progress, which got its money from First Energy. It's almost like you have to kind of trace the money back.
Right. You got to connect the dots. We knew there was a dark money group supporting Alice DeWine. What we didn't know is that next step back. Right. Farnoosh Amiri, what do we know about Ohioans who were at the riots, the riot in Washington last week? We know there were busloads of them being headed there. Any news on that front?
So that's been, I think, every state is trying to figure out how many of their or state's residents were a part of Wednesday's actions. And as far as the U.S. Attorney in the Northern District of Ohio and the Southern District of Ohio, they have not released any numbers or names for how many Ohioans took part and how many of them are being investigated. I did report on Friday that there was a occupational therapist in Cleveland who resigned after there was rumors that she was involved, and there was a lot of social media people. There was a woman standing in a red coat at the Senate dais, and that was like really spread around. And so she resigned from her role at the Cleveland Metropolitan School District. But never once in her resignation letter does she mention the riots. It does go in line with QAnon theories and anti-vax movements. So that it seems to be the only one that has been made public, but it does seem that both U.S. attorneys are trying to stay mum on investigations until they have really accurate numbers and information on that.
Governor DeWine has accepted the resignation of Susan Allen Block from the Ohio Arts Council. It's a very prestigious kind of an appointment. It was after her controversial tweet supporting the riots and calling Vice President-elect Kamala Harris a whore. What about that? I mean, what I understood was that Susan Allen Block had already been using her social media platforms to criticize and criticize opponents of the president and defend the president. Laura?
Well, I think using the word whore to, label the vice president-elect is like a whole new level.
Yeah.
The attack on the Capitol really kind of put a lot more attention and scrutiny on these kinds of statements. There was Twitter did a purge over the weekend, and there was a former vice chair of the Montgomery County, vice chair of the Montgomery County Republican Party who got suspended. And it was in part because she espoused QAnon theories. So I think that there's more attention to some of this hot rhetoric that is on social media from people like Susan Block.
Farnoosh?
And I think it's also because this is the first time that these actions on these or these conversations and plans on these websites like 4chan and Parler have been shown to be serious. I think has a lot to do with why Capitol Police and federal authorities were not as prepared, because they didn't take Trump supporters and these groups seriously. And I think now that they've shown that their words and their posts can be relayed into real life, I think a lot of people like Twitter and Facebook and other people are taking them a lot more seriously than ever before.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Reporters at speaking of Susan Allen Block, reporters at the Block-owned newspaper, the Toledo Blade, went on a byline strike. That means they pull their byline after the union complained that journalists were told to soften critical coverage of Trump, and also the headlines and that kind of a thing and words were changed in their stories to reflect that lean. Jackie Borchardt, what about that? And how big of a deal is it? I think that Blade reporters have done byline strikes before.
Yeah, the byline strike for people who aren't familiar with it is a way to show that the reporters don't stand behind the work that's being posted, published in the paper. It's something that is obvious when people are reading that it doesn't look right, and so it's akin to holding like some sort of a sign, but one that all of your readers can see.
Five Republicans from Ohio, House members from Ohio, objected to the certification of the electoral ballots. Jim Jordan of Urbana, Bill Johnson of Marietta, Bob Gibbs of Lakeville, Steve Shabbat of Cincinnati, Warren Davidson of Troy. These are all very, very safe districts. Am I right, Laura Bischoff? And that this could probably won't have repercussions for them, all things being equal.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, Ohio's famously gerrymandered districts means that, you know, the incumbents are safe. I think it's not going to have a big blowback for them.
Mm-hmm. But they are getting ready to redraw the lines.
Yeah, although I think that probably when they redraw, they may take Ohio's expected to lose a seat, and I think that what they'll do is they'll draw out a seat that maybe somebody's getting ready to retire from, or maybe it's somebody who they're not who's fallen out of favor. So we'll see. I don't think it's going to be Jim Jordan or Warren Davidson that lose their seats.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, Dayton Daily News State House reporter Laura Bischoff, and Farnoosh Amiri, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks to all of you. There was a clash between pro-Trump supporters and Black Lives Matter counter-demonstrators at the Ohio State House on Wednesday. What do we know about whether this was, were these just a lot of people that couldn't make it to Washington? What do we know about them, Jackie Borchardt?
Yeah, I mean, I was not there. Okay. From reports from my colleagues in Columbus and in the press, the State House press corps. There were Ohioans who didn't, you know, get on a bus and go to D.C. There were several kind of skirmishes. One kind of nasty punch that was caught on video that I think got national attention. But that was, you know, there was a small group of, you know, kind of counter protesters who showed up. I think after that, the police had not been right there. For a lot of this activity, they were there, and it seemed like the groups were mostly separated, and they left by a little bit after 3. So when all of the action at the Capitol started really taking off, there was, you know, not, I had people asking me if the State House at downtown was similarly escalating, and it was not.
It was not, but and clearly was not. There were other state houses around the country that were likewise the sites of demonstrations, protests, whatnot. But there's a lot of static on social media about drawing people to state houses across the country on the same day as inauguration, like making this a nationwide protest. Farnoosh, have you heard anything about that?
So actually, before what happened on Wednesday took place, there was a lot of conversation online in these subgroups and private chats about January 17th, which is Saturday. And that's supposed to be the day where they're encouraging everyone to come to their state house and to protest. And this was the day that was supposed to be actually taking over the U.S. Capitol. So I believe Wednesday's was, doesn't seem like it was much of a planned out as Saturday is. So what is concerning about Saturday is the same thing that was concerning about Wednesday. And that is what Jackie mentioned of like lack of police, lack of intel about what's going on, not being prepared, or in the case, I mean, we saw in many social media videos, there were protesters and mob rioters that were taking photos with police and they were live streaming with them and police actually opened the door for them to go in. So there's going to be a lot of eyes on every single state house in the country on Saturday as we see what the response is going to be. Now that they know they have enough time, they should be able to, I mean, DeWine should be able to get the resources, the National Guard, that he did the same thing with the Black Lives Matter movement. He did it with the protest lockdown, the protests on the lockdowns over the summer. So it'll be really interesting to see if any state officials learn from what happened at the Capitol.
Yeah, Laura Bischoff?
Oh, I would just note that January 17th is Sunday instead of Saturday.
Oh, okay. So it is going to be on January 17th, or at least that's what they're shooting for.
Yes. Okay. And there is also a plan for Inauguration Day, but that is, I mean, the way that they're locking down the inauguration at the U.S. Capitol, it's not clear what will actually happen there, but eyes will also be on the State House then.
And, you know, the State House is, the Ohio State House is protected by the Highway Patrol.
Right.
You know, over 2020, during the Black Lives Matters protests and also the protests over public health orders, the State House, I think, had about $250,000 in damage done to it. And they put up boards over all the first floor windows. I expect that we'll probably see those boards back up again sometime this week in preparation for this weekend.
The governor signed the Stand Your Ground bill into law. What's been the repercussions for him, Jackie Borch? Well, let's start with Laura Bischoff in Dayton. Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley obviously is at the forefront of the movement to oppose liberalizing gun restrictions in the state of Ohio. You know, after the mass shooting there a year and a half ago, what's been the reaction?
Well, you know, I think that people in Dayton are extremely disappointed. And I think Nan Whaley, the Dayton mayor, has expressed that disappointment, saying that he said he was going to do something. He said he was going to stand by us. And instead, he signed Stand Your Ground. This was not what the people who were shouting at the vigil in August of 2019, just the day or two after the mass shooting in the Oregon district, this is not what they had in mind. Governor DeWine says, he promised, he made a campaign promise,
right,
to sign such legislation, and that he's going to continue to push for what he calls Strong Ohio. It's a package of bills that aren't as strong as what gun control advocates wanted, like a true red flag law, but it would, beef up the background check system a little bit. And he's talked a lot about having stiffer penalties for people who are prohibited from having a gun, and then they do have a gun and illegally and they commit another crime, sort of that tough on crime approach. And I would also say that Nan Whaley last week announced that she's not seeking reelection for a third term as Dayton mayor. She's probably one of the two or three best known Democrats in Ohio, which is sort of a low bar. I mean, I don't think a lot of people outside of the Dayton area know who Nan Whaley is. But I do expect that she will run for governor against Mike DeWine or against whoever gets the Republican nomination in 2022. She's already expressed an interest in that job. She ran in the Democratic primary. I think just she was in the race for maybe 5 or 6 months and then she dropped out and backed Rich Cordray.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the governor said he would sign Stand Your Ground legislation, right? But he also said he wouldn't sign it until Strong Ohio or Stronger Ohio. I can't remember.
Strong Ohio.
Strong Ohio. Yeah. Well, he wanted that enacted first. Is this a capitulation, Jackie Borchardt?
You know, we went back and looked and he first kind of made that. It's not even a threat, but that kind of, I think you should be focusing on these other bills instead. He first said that a year before the bill finally passed.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that he loses much at the State House for sure. It helps him. You know, the Senate and House are even more controlled by Republicans than they were. That the Stand Your Ground legislation has been discussed and debated around the State House for years and years. It's one of those things that, given the makeup of the legislature, it
it's inevitable it would end up on the governor's desk. Mm-hmm. The next, you know, Kasich vetoed it, but it would be back. And, you know, the governor behind the scenes was fighting pretty hard in December to make sure that a bill that would have limited the health director's ability to, you know, issue a stay-at-home order, some of these other health orders that the state has relied on during the pandemic, to make sure that that stayed dead and didn't come back, and that they wouldn't come back and override his veto. So I think, you know, given the, and like Laura just mentioned, there will be a primary. I think he's anticipating a primary challenge. You know, President Trump has even said he would maybe, you know, support some sort of primary challenge back when, after, in the days after the election, when Governor DeWine said, yeah, Joe Biden is vice president-elect. You know, that prompted a tweet from President Trump saying, oh, I wonder who's going to run for the primary in 2022. So, you know, all of these things together, we shouldn't have been surprised, but, you know, I think he still really wants to get those other things passed. And some of those things in that bill are really low hanging fruit, in the sense that pro Second Amendment groups do support them. So maybe it's an instance where they need to be teased out in individual bills or something. But, you know, we're in a new session. So starting over with somewhat of a fresh slate, and certainly in better, probably better relations than at some points in last year.
Farnoosh Amiri, so what's next for gun control legislation then? I mean, well, let me say this. What about gun rights legislation? Is there anything else in the buffet that they haven't picked up yet?
There are a number of things that were left on the table when the session ended in December, but it does seem like, I mean, DeWine has said this, and I think, the legislature doesn't agree with him, but he does seem to think that after this stand your ground measure that was passed, there needs to be more focus on, like, making sure people are not killed by guns than giving more rights to people who own guns. I mean, that's how DeWine feels. Obviously, we were surprised that he signed the measure, but it remains to be unknown. I mean, the amount of gun violence in the city of Columbus just in the past 11 days is crazy, and is already beating records that were set last year. So it's kind of all up in the air as of right now.
Laura Bischoff?
You know, I'd say that, you know, Stand Your Ground was one of those issues, like Jackie said, it was many years in the making. It had been on the wish list for a long, long time. It might be one of the biggest changes to gun policy in Ohio since Ted Strickland signed the Castle Doctrine law into effect, I think in 2008-ish. And that was like stand your ground for your house and your occupied vehicle. And I think there's probably permitless concealed carry would be the other, the next thing on the wish list for gun rights groups. And it's an idea that's been around for, I think Jim Aslanides was pushing that bill back when I started covering the legislature almost 20 years ago. That would be where you don't need a permit. You don't have to have a background check or any kind of training. As long as you have a legal right to carry a weapon, you could do so without going through that. So I think that would be the next thing on the wish list.
Okay. COVID-19, the vaccination distribution plan has it that the group 1B distribution will begin next week, starting with those 80 and older. There's about 400,000 people that fall into that category in Ohio, but the governor said there's only about 100,000 doses of the vaccine expected for that group. How are they going to prioritize? Farnoosh, do you know, have they talked about that?
So he's been pretty clear that this is what the situation is, and he's trying to get as many people vaccinated as possible. While obviously a lot of people are frustrated with how slow the process has been, how unclear some of the details and distribution plans have been, he's made it clear that this was way less than the federal government had promised a lot of states. So they are not exactly on plan with how many people they were supposed to vaccinate by now or will continue to vaccinate. But after January 19th, which is when people 80 years and older will begin to be available for the vaccine, as we know, they are not, it's not enforced, so it just depends on who signs up to come and get it. The state is expected to lower the age threshold by 5 years each week following that. So it'll be 75 years and older eligible, and then beginning January 25th, and then 70 and older eligible beginning on February 1st, and it'll just keep going down every 5 years.
Laura?
Yeah, there's, you know, there's this 1B group is massive. There's like 2.2 million Ohioans in that group. And so, you know, it's worse than a game of musical chairs. It's just not going to be enough chairs for everyone. There's not, it's not going to, you know, it's going to be a while before all of 1B gets vaccinated. And, you know, I remember in early December, I think December 5th, we wrote a story in which the governor was talking about how many doses of Moderna and Pfizer vaccines Ohio expected to receive by the end of December. And it was like 650,000 doses. Mm-hmm. And I checked this morning and we've had 297,000 Ohioans vaccinated so far. So that's like less than half of what we had expected. And we're 11 days into January. So I think this, you know, this vaccination rollout has got some pinch points and problems in the supply line and in the logistics. And it's kind of like a repeat of all the problems we had with like the testing system at the front end of this pandemic and the lack of PPE and the rest of it. And, you know, it's too bad that we, you know, over the last 6 to 8 months that we didn't have it ironed out. Like we knew this was coming at some point, right?
Right. Is it a function of not getting enough vaccine, or is it as you say, is it more the logistics of figuring out how to get the vaccines to the people?
I think it's both.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then as far as the testing goes, correct me if I'm wrong, but they think they're going to be getting, they're really ramping that up now, right?
I think so. Maybe for an issue, Jackie might have more details on that.
Coronavirus testing?
Yeah.
I'm not aware of any effort to ramp that up more. Testing kind of ramped up in the late fall as we saw more of those antigen tests that can give you results within, you know, 15 minutes or so. So the state is definitely getting more of those than we were a couple months ago. But, and I think anybody who is looking at the daily data that the Ohio Department of Health puts out is aware that the cases and the testing is kind of all over the place. You know, a big reason for that is we just went through two holiday weeks. And when you have a holiday, you have labs closing, you have testing sites where people can go, you know, outpatient care and the fairgrounds and all of those sites, you know, are not open on holidays or around holidays or at reduced time, or people just aren't going to go on a holiday to get a test. So I'm hoping we'll start to see some sort of like stabilization, at least in that, because right now it's hard to use some of that data to kind of see where we're at. And that's why the hospitalization data is important. And if you look at that, we've kind of plateaued at around like 4,200, 4,300 people who are in hospitals receiving treatment on any given day across the state. And the local hospitals are watching those numbers really carefully, because of course that goes into how their staffing needs and whether they need to. And we've had stories just in the last 2 weeks of how, you know, a hospital may be full on a certain day. And so the ambulances are directed to take patients elsewhere. Things like that are still happening. So even if you see a low, I think we had a lowish day in the last couple of days, like maybe 5,000 or 6,000 new cases, we're still in the middle of it here. And the vaccine there is a concern that we're not going to be able to give the vaccine to enough people in a short enough time that we really kind of stem this. And that's why they're pushing to have these older populations, people who are more at risk of complications and of dying, getting the vaccine first.
Jackie Borchardt, U.S. I'm sorry, we got to cut it off, guys. Yep, I apologize. Sorry. Jackie Borchardt, USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau Chief. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Bischoff, State Government Reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Thanks to you, Laura, as well.
Always a pleasure.
And Farnoosh Amiri, welcome to the show. State House Reporter for the Associated Press. Appreciate it. That's it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.